It is said that everybody likes a good mystery. Mystery intrigues many people, and there are many books and novels that are based on mysteries, mostly murder mysteries. And of course, there's a lot of different TV shows and movies that are about different mysteries. The Bible mentions a mystery as well. In fact, the Bible has quite a few mysteries in there that is mentioned in the Bible. But today, I kind of want to focus on one of the mysteries. And the one that I'm looking at today is actually used as a title. Revelation chapter 17. In Revelation chapter 17, verse 5. And on her forehead was a name was written. Mystery. Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and the abominations of the earth. Mystery Babylon. Today I will begin a two-part sermon entitled Mystery Babylon, which I will go into solving this great mystery. First, we're going to look at the origin of this mystery and then how it evolved into something greater in the second part, which will be next Sabbath. And it's quite a bit of information. So next Sabbath, I might actually be doing two splits to get everything through, because there's a lot of information that we have to go through. So let's take a look at the word mystery itself. Now, the word mystery is, according to Strong's coordinates, is number 3466, if anybody's keeping track of those things. But the Greek word is mysterion. Mysterion. It's from a derivative of muo, which means to shut the mouth. It's a secret or mystery through the idea of silence imposed by initiation into some type of religious rites is where this mystery comes from. Now, in Vine's expository dictionary, the word is defined here as mystery is that which denotes not the mysterious, as with the English word, but that which, being outside the range of unassisted natural apprehension, can be made known only by divine revelation, and is made known in a manner and at a time appointed by God to those only who are illuminated by His Spirit. In other words, a mystery in the biblical sense, or in the Greek sense as well, is something that is unattainable by common human research, but is revealed by God so that His children, His people, can understand. Of mystery, William Barclay's The Letters to the Corinthians says, the Greek word mysterion means something whose meaning is hidden from those who have not been initiated, but crystal clear to those who have. A mystery in the New Testament is something that had at one time before been hidden, but now has been revealed to God's people. Jesus spoke of the mystery of the kingdom of God in Mark chapter 4, verse 11, for an example. That He was at that point actually revealing to His disciples. Now, Matthew chapter 13 and verse 10. And the disciples came and said to Him, why do you speak to them in parables? And He answered and said to them, because it has been given to you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it has not been given. The apostle Paul used the word mystery 21 times in his epistles. In each case, the mystery involved a wonderful declaration of spiritual truth revealed by God through divine inspiration. A mystery is that by which, when you read, you may understand my knowledge in the mystery of Christ, which in other ages has not been made known to the sons of men, as it has now been revealed by the Spirit to his holy apostles and prophets. That's Ephesians chapter 3, verses 4 and 5. Now we know that God reveals the mysteries to us. In Daniel chapter 2, verses 28 through 29, you don't have to turn there, but Daniel tells Nebuchadnezzar that God is the one who reveals secrets. God is the one who reveals secrets. So look at again at Revelation chapter 17, verse 5 and 7. It is interesting that God labeled this woman as a mystery. He goes on to say, through the angel, I will show you the mystery of the woman and of the beast. Revelation 17 and 18 contain many clues as to her identification. Mystery refers to information which has been kept secret, but unveiled later to God's people. Romans chapter 16, Romans chapter 16, beginning in verse 25. Now to him who is able to establish you according to my gospel and the preaching of Jesus Christ, according to the revelation of the mystery kept secret since the world began, but now made manifest, and by the prophetic scriptures made known to all nations according to the commandment of the everlasting God for obedience to the faith. So let's see what the Bible has revealed to us. And we will also look at some historical records, commentaries from the Bible scholars, and some of the UCG Beyond Today publications. But we have to start at the very beginning, which is actually, in this case, John chapter 1, verse 1. John chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. That is the absolute beginning. And we've covered this a lot lately, and know that this verse is telling us that God the Father and the Word, who became Jesus Christ, were together with no ending, no beginning. They are eternal beings who have always existed. They decided together to create offspring. And in Genesis chapter 1, they say, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. So God created man in his own image. But before this, in their heavenly realm, they created the angels. Many different types of angels, according to the scripture. A lot of detail when it comes to the angels. And like everything else, they were created through the divine Word who became Jesus Christ. For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him. Colossians chapter 1 and verse 16 says that. Now we are given three names of archangels, which means chief angel or chief messenger. And all have God's name in their name, Elohim. They have the prefix, or suffix, I should say, of El, E-L. in their name. First, we have Michael L, a name that means who is like God. And he is referred to in Daniel chapter 10, verse 13, as one of the chief princes. That is one of the leading rulers in the angelic realm. We are told that part of Michael's job, responsibilities, is looking after the nations of Israel and fighting for the people of God in times of war. Michael, as you know, and his angels fought against the dragon, Satan, that's mentioned in Revelation. I'm pretty sure that Michael's in charge of those guardian angels that we always are looking to help us and protect us. He's got lots of responsibilities. Second, we have Gabriel. A name that means strong man of God or God's strength. He is possibly an archangel too, although the Bible doesn't directly state this. But Gabriel was shown throughout Scripture to have a role in bringing good news to mankind and also making different pronouncements. We know that he is the one that brought the good news of the coming of Jesus Christ to Joseph and Mary. And I'm sure that he was the one that went out there in the fields where the shepherds were and told them about Jesus coming. You know, Gabriel is another one of those that, you know, is out there helping God with everything that he does. Now, the third archangel Jesus created was the most beautiful and majestic of all the angels that he created. The name that was given to him is really unknown. It's unknown. He does have many titles, many different names, but that was after he turned against his creator. One of the names that we will use is Hillel. Hillel. That's H-E-Y-L-E-L. Hillel. In Isaiah chapter 14 in verse 12, one of the versions of this says, "How are you fallen from heaven, O day star?" O day star, Hillel, in Hebrew, Hillel. O day star, son of dawn, how you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. Now, according to John Gill's exposition on the Bible, this angel is alluding to the star Venus, the morning star, which ushers in the light in the morning and shows that the day is at hand. Though he was once an angel of light and sometimes transforms himself into one, it's a little different now. The good angels are also called morning stars, according to Job 38, verse 7. And such he and his angels once were. Now, the Targum, which is the Aramaic translation or interpretation of the Hebrew Bible, states this verse this way: "How art thou falling from on high, who is shining among the sons of men, as the star Venus among the stars?" Hillel, in actual fact, has nothing whatsoever to do with bringing any light. It has a positive meaning of to shine, and thus is frequently translated as praise or as glory in the Old Testament. But Hallel also has a negative meaning, and that of to boast, to be mad, to be foolish, to rage. The name could be Shining One or Arrogant Boaster or Howler. Hallel was the Hebrew name for the day star, that is, the planet Venus. Now, the Latin name Lucifer is a misinterpretation which Jerome used in the Vulgate Bible translation that he wrote between 382 and 405 AD. No one in biblical times ever referred to this archangel as Lucifer. Lucifer is actually a title of Christ, one that this archangel stole. This rebellious angel became Satan, meaning adversary, the enemy, opponent, antagonist, or foe. Satan's arrogance and vanity ultimately led to outright and open rebellion against God. This powerful spirit entity decided to challenge God for control of the universe in the heavenly realm. But why? Why? This is where we really need to pay attention to understand how the mystery of Revelation 17 began. Hallel also had responsibilities as the other archangels had. He was one of the covering angels of God's throne, as mentioned in Ezekiel 28, verse 14. He would also have another duty, but first of all, let's catch up on the timeline here. God created his angelic beings and gave them tasks. And now he begins. Now he begins his great plan. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. In God's response to Job, we see that the angels witnessed the physical creation of the universe out of nothing. And they were astonished. They were amazed. In Job chapter 38 and verse 4, God says to Job, in Job 38 verse 4, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy." Here, God here reveals information to us that no man could know, since no man was present at the creation. God describes the earth as at its creation as a dazzling, beautiful jewel floating in space. The creation events were so magnificent that all the angels shouted for joy. The angels, the spirit beings that God had created, already existed when God made the earth. And they were all united in joy when God created the earth and the world and the universe. They were all singing and shouting in exultation. They were in perfect harmony, in agreement at that time. What I just read was from the United Church of God's booklet on angels. Again, all the angels were given responsibilities which revolved around God's great plan to create an offspring for himself. The archangels most likely knew of God's plan. They knew the Creator's plan. They were there in the planning meeting and how they fulfilled their roles in this great plan. Hillel and the angels under his authority were given a special task. They were assigned to earth to prepare it for the coming of the God kind, mankind. Jude 6 tells us that Hillel and his angels failed in their mission on earth. Jude 6 reads, "And the angels who did not keep their positions of authority, but abandoned their own home, these God has kept in darkness, bound with everlasting chains for the judgment on the great day." That's the NIV version of that verse. Now, no one knows how long the angels dwelled on earth. Nobody knows what they were doing when they were on earth. But from Scripture, we know that they were on earth. They were here doing something. Now, many people can speculate on what they were doing. There's a lot of other mysteries out there that we don't know, but I know one thing for sure is one day we will know. So we don't want to really speculate on what they were doing. There's a lot of questions. People can say, well, what about the dinosaurs? Well, I don't know. Maybe they had dinosaurs. Maybe they were playing with dinosaurs. I don't know. The thing is we don't know that, and we don't want to speculate on those things. God did everything for a purpose. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to drive here today if it wasn't for the dinosaurs. Think about that. Where do you think they got all that oil and gasoline from? Dead dinosaurs. God worked out things in his own plan. Jesus Christ could have been down there with them creating things. Who knows? We don't want to speculate on that. We just want to know that they were here and they failed at that mission. They failed. What we do know from Scripture is that Hillel rebelled against God, rebelled against his Creator. In Isaiah chapter 14, we find more information about this angelic rebellion and identifying its ringleader. It gives us important details and how we can learn in no other way. Now, I'm going to be reading from the United Church of God's booklet, Is There Really a Devil? There's a lot of good information in here, and so I'm going to read a lot from that. In Isaiah chapter 14 and verse 4, God addresses the king of Babylon. In Isaiah's time, the city-state of Babylon was emerging as a major power in that region of the world. His king was a warmonger, expanding his empire through brute force. He enslaved, plundered, and devastated the nations around him. In context, this passage has a dual meaning in that it also refers to an end-time tyrant who will rule over a final global empire referred to in Revelation chapter 17 and 18 as Babylon the Great. Our mystery Babylon. Mystery Babylon. The philosophy of the king of Babylon here is satanic, acquiring wealth and power at the expense of others, gaining it through violence and bloodshed. The king of Babylon thus exemplifies Satan and his characters. The subject shifts all of a sudden from this physical king to a ruler who is yet higher. Many scholars recognize that the original language of this passage is in the form of a lament, a reflection of God's mourning in a sense of a great loss due to the events being described. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, from the English Standard Version. How you are falling from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you were cut down in the ground, you who laid the nations low. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God. I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the far reaches of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. As we know from Revelation chapter 1 and verse 20, that stars symbolize angels. So who is this being that dares exalt himself above the other angels of God to challenge God himself as ruler of the universe? In Ezekiel chapter 28, God gives us the answer. This chapter is written much like Isaiah chapter 14. God begins discussing a human ruler, then shifts to a spiritual power behind the earthly throne. The behind-the-scenes ruler who controls the kingdoms of this world. In Ezekiel chapter 28, verse 2, God addresses the Prince of Tyre. Now, Tyre was a coastal port city north of ancient Israel on the Mediterranean Sea, and was famous for a major trading center. Its Phoenician rulers had grown haughty and presumptuous because of their wealth and influence. In Ezekiel chapter 28, verses 6 through 10, God tells this ruler that because of his arrogance, his might and wealth would fail and he would be overthrown. But notice Ezekiel chapter 28 and verse 12, that God all of a sudden begins to address the king of Tyre rather than the prince. This figure is the true ruler, the real power behind the throne. History gives some additional insight here, as the patron god of the ancient Tyre was Melkart, meaning king of the city. He was deemed to be the true ruler of Tyre. And considering that the false gods of this world can represent actual demonic powers, Satan being the chief among them as the god of this age, according to 2 Corinthians chapter 4 and verse 4. Now, still reading from this booklet, is there really a devil? In fact, God's description of this king of Tyre makes it clear that he is speaking to no physical human being. Beginning in verse 12 there, you were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, in the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering. I'm going to skip all the stones there. The workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day that you were created. No mortal man could accurately be described as being the seal of perfection, full of wisdom, and perfect in beauty. This entity was created. Unlike human beings who were born rather than created, except for Adam and Eve. This being had been in Eden, in the garden of God. Other than Adam and Eve, no people had been in the Garden of Eden. God had expelled them, after which he placed an angel there specifically to prevent anyone from entering, which is mentioned in Genesis chapter 3, verse 24. As mentioned before, this angelic being covered the throne of God. and was in heaven, which no man has ever gone. He was given authority over other angels. God said to this cherub, "You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created till iniquity was found in you." Ezekiel 28, verse 15. Like the description in Isaiah 14, this passage describes a created being, not a man. This being was extraordinary perfect until he sinned, beginning with pride in his own beauty and splendor, which corrupted his wisdom. Apparently, this archangel, LL, disagreed with the plan of God and became jealous of the offspring that God was going to create, as his pride was so great. He realized that these human beings that were going to be brought in had the potential to become like God, to be children of God, which he would never be able to be. He wasn't happy with his present condition. He wanted more. But even though he was made perfect, he chose to go against his creator and become the adversary of God, Satan. Satan's sin of pride and vanity ultimately led to outright and open rebellion against God. In Isaiah chapter 14, verses 13 and 14, which we read a little bit later, but it states that you said in your heart, "I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars or the angels of God. I will sit enthroned on the mount of assembly, on the utmost heights of the sacred mountain. I will ascend above the tops of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High." That's the New International Version. This powerful spiritual entity decided to challenge God for control of the universe, and by his own will became the devil, Satan, the adversary, the slanderer, the accuser, the destroyer. He made that decision. God did not create a devil. Hillel created the devil himself. He made himself the enemy of God and humanity. The immense powers that he had used in God's service were now turned not to serve God, but to try to thwart God's purpose. This creature remains an enormous, powerful spiritual being, and now his powers are used for wicked and destructive ends. Satan wasn't alone in this rebellion. Millions of other angels joined him in rejecting God's authority and leadership. We find this symbolically described in Revelation chapter 12 and verses 3 and 4, where it says, "And another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, the great fiery red dragon, and his tail drew a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth." As we know, the stars are angels. A third of the angels. Verse 7. "And war broke out in heaven. Michael and his angels fought with the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought. But they did not prevail, nor was their place found in them in heaven any longer. So the great dragon was cast out, that serpent of old called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. He was cast to the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." Jesus said that Satan fell like lightning from heaven in Luke chapter 10, verse 18. It seems likely that this titanic struggle is what brought about the chaotic and wasted conditions of earth that is described in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2. In Rotherham's emphasized Bible, Genesis chapter 1, verse 2 appropriately reads, "Now the earth had become waste and empty." Genesis chapter 1, verse 2 tells us that after creation, the earth became a wasteland and empty. We know from Isaiah chapter 45 in verse 18 that God did not create it in vain. He did not create everything in vain. So if God did not create the earth in a state of waste, how did it become in that condition? Hillel's war against heaven, where Michael defended God's heavenly throne. Now we know that God probably just could have snapped his fingers and been over with like that, but Michael had a responsibility and he let Michael fulfill that responsibility to protect heaven. And he did. The evidence of this war can be seen throughout the universe. Planets and moons have been scarred or destroyed by the spiritual war. This universe itself is chaotic. And we know that God did not create everything in vain. But now it's chaotic. There's stars crashing into stars. There's galaxies colliding with other galaxies. There's things flying all over the place. There's suns flying through space. That just amazes me when we understand that, when all these suns and everything's happening and all of a sudden, boom, this big explosion happens and it sends a whole sun. It seems a star, even larger than our own sun, flying through space. Was it headed this way? I mean, I know the universe is a big place, but there's a lot of things out there that are disastrous. When you look at the universe and you look at how small and insignificant this little planet is, we know that God is protecting this planet. You can see destruction all over the place out there. Yet God is protecting us because he's a loving God. Now the rest of Genesis chapter 1, you know, God goes through renewing the surface of the earth in preparation for human habitation. Yet to aid his purpose in developing righteous character in human beings, God allowed Satan and his minions to remain on earth for the time being. Thus Satan was allowed to tempt Adam and Eve in the garden. Satan now attempts and succeeds in destroying God's relationship with his first potential offspring. We know the story, how Satan deceived Eve into making her doubt God. According to 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 14, Adam wasn't deceived. He just went along with it. He simply followed along and joined his wife in disobeying God's clear instructions. Genesis chapter 3 and verse 4. Continuing on with the timeline. "Then the serpent said to the woman, 'You will not surely die. For God knows that in that day that you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil.'" Here is the first lie: that mankind is immortal, or that man has an immortal soul. Satan is the only one that says this throughout the whole Bible. He's the only one that says we are immortal. God doesn't say it. Christ doesn't say it. Nobody says it. Only him. Yet many religions, including Christianity, still claims that the soul of a man is immortal. They believe the lie as well. The other thing that we get from Satan's statement here is that we don't have to wait for God to be like him. We don't have to wait. But that we ourselves can become like God. Adam and Eve were on track. We're on track to become the first newborn gods in God's family. But Satan convinced them that they did not have to wait for that. They didn't have to wait on God to make that happen. That they could take this fruit and have it right now. They took a shortcut. They tried to take a shortcut in becoming like God. And it only brought them death. There's so many people out there that say you can have everything now. You can have the kingdom now. You don't have to wait for God. You can have it now. Just send me $9.99. And I'll give you this booklet and we'll tell you how you can get it all now. Satan's primary goal to thwart God's plan to build a family relationship with mankind. That is his plan. To destroy his plans for creating his offspring. From the beginning, God has had a magnificent plan for human beings to extend us the gift of eternal life. Why would he have to give us the gift of eternal life if we already had it? If we were already immortal? Doesn't pass the common sense test, does it? God's goal is to vastly expand his family, but now it was thwarted by Satan. But it was just a temporary setback. Genesis chapter 3, verse 15. And I will put an enmity between you and the woman, and between your seed and her seed. He shall bruise your head, and you shall bruise his heel. Here, God, the Word, the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ, first mentions the prophecy of himself being born in the flesh to save mankind. Think about that. So was that plan B? Or did God always know that he would need to do this? That this would have to be so? Satan knows the plan. And he set out to do whatever he could to ruin the plan. After successfully getting Adam and Eve kicked out of the garden, he set his eye on their firstborn son, Cain. He knew from the prophecy that one born of Eve would destroy him. He thought it was Cain. He successfully planted the seeds of jealousy in Cain, which jealousy does come from Satan. As he's jealous. But not only did Satan get Cain to go his way, and in the process, he got Cain to eliminate Abel. Now, Satan continued to infiltrate mankind, turning them all evil, like he did to the angels that he was in charge of. Satan will never, ever give up as he believes that he can still win. Remember that. He will never give up. Now, God was so upset with mankind following Satan, that he decided to start all over again with Noah and his family. See, God does not give up on those who follow his way. He doesn't give up on anybody. Some are just going to have to wait for the second resurrection. But he's still going to give them a chance and an opportunity. God does not give up on those that follow his way. Again, neither does Satan. As he began to start to corrupt Noah's descendants, they all knew of God, but began to turn away, relying on themselves and others. Now enters an interesting character, Nimrod. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 8. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 8. Cush begot Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one on earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Eternal. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Eternal. In the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneen, in the land of Shinar. From that land he went to Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth, and Calah, and Rison between Nineveh and Calah. That is the principal city. Now, reading from Keel and Delitzsch's commentary on the Old Testament, says, Nimrod began to be a mighty one in the earth. Nimrod was mighty in hunting, and that in opposition to the Eternal. Not before the Eternal in the sense of according to the purpose of the will of the Eternal. Just the opposite. The name itself, Nimrod, from Marad, M-A-R-A-D, which means we will revolt, points to some violent resistance to God. Nimrod, as a mighty hunter, founded a powerful kingdom. And in founding this kingdom, is shown by the verb with consecutive to have been the consequence or the result of his strength in hunting, so that hunting was intimately connected with the establishment of his kingdom. Hence, if the expression a mighty hunter relates primarily to hunting in the literal sense, we must add to the literal meaning of the figurative signification of the hunter of men, a trapper of men by force. Nimrod, the hunter, became a tyrant, a powerful hunter of men. Now, the International Standard Version reads that he became a fearless hunter in defiance of the Eternal. That is why it is said, like Nimrod, a fearless hunter in defiance of the Eternal. This is how it really should be read and understood. First, what does the name Nimrod mean? Again, it comes from the Hebrew word marad, meaning rebel. They add an N before the M, which became an infinitive construct, Nimrod. The meaning then is the rebel. The rebel. Thus, Nimrod may not actually be the character's name at all. It's more of a derisive term of a type, a representative of a system that is epitomized in the rebellion against the Creator, the one true God. Rebellion began soon after the flood, as civilizations were restored. At that time, this person became very prominent. So this name Nimrod may just be like one of the names that is given to Satan before his, you know, before his fall. You know, meaning that it's not their real name, but it's more of a descriptive name because of their actions. We know Satan as Satan because he's the adversary. It's not a very glamorous name. It's a descriptive name. Same with Hillel. That's not really his name. It was just describing that he was this arrogant boaster. So we really don't know his true name. Now, from the Antiquities of the Jews by Flavius Josephus in Book 1, Chapter 4, if you're keeping track. Now it was Nimrod who excited them to such an affront and contempt to God. Everybody knows Josephus, the historian, Jewish historian. He goes on to say he was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man and of great strength of hand. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as if it was through his means that they were happy, but to believe it was through their own courage which produced that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God, but to bring them into constant dependence on his power. He also said that he would be revenged on God. If he should have a mind to drown the world again, for that he would build a tower too high for the waters to be able to reach, that he would avenge himself on God for destroying their forefathers. Again, he convinced the people that that rainbow up there meant nothing. It wasn't a promise of God. They were destroying the rainbow before modern civilization decided to destroy the rainbow. Now the multitude were very ready to follow the determination of Nimrod and esteem it a piece of cowardice to submit to God. And they built a tower, neither sparing any pains nor being in any degree of neglect about the work. And by reason of the multitude of hands employed in it, it grew very high, sooner than anyone could expect. But the thickness of it was so great, and it was so strongly built, that thereby its great height seemed, upon the view, to be less than it really was. It was built of burnt bricks, cemented together with mortar, made of bitumen, that it might not be liable to admit water. They were making it waterproof. When God saw that they had acted so madly, he did not resolve to destroy them utterly, since they were not grown wiser by the destruction of the former sinners. But he caused atonement among the men by producing in them divers language, and causing that through the multitude of those languages, they should not be able to understand one another. The place wherein they built the tower is now called Babylon, because of the confusion of that language which they readily understood before. For the Hebrews mean by the word Babel, confusion. Josephus also mentions another book out there, the Sibyl, which is, if you don't know that, it's kind of like, the Sibyl is kind of like an oracle that wrote down different historical things as well. But the Sibyl also makes mention of this tower and the confusion of the language. When she says thus, when all men were of one language, some of them built a high tower, as they would thereby ascend up to heaven. And the gods sent storms of wind and overthrew the tower and gave everyone his particular language. And for this reason, it was that the city was called Babylon. Another historical document that's out there. Now in Genesis chapter 10, verses 8 and 11, we learn that Nimrod established a kingdom. Therefore, one would expect to find also in literature of the ancient Near East a person who was a type, for an example, for all the people to follow. And there was. It is a well-known tale, common to this Sumerian literature, of a man that fits the description. Now, in addition to the Sumerians, the Babylonians wrote about this person. The Assyrians likewise, and the Hittites. Even in Israel, tablets have been found with this man's name on them. And he was obviously the most popular hero in ancient Near East. Now, the Bible mentions this Nimrod character, but are there any historical figures that actually fit the description, since we really know that his name wasn't really Nimrod? Now, there are a few prominent theories that are now held in regard to Nimrod's true identity. One of them was adopted by G. Smith and Jeremias, also supported by Skinner, Diver, Delitzsch, and others, that Nimrod is to be identified with the Babylonian hero Izdubar, or Jishdubar, otherwise known as Gilgamesh, the flood hero of Babylonia. Now, Gilgamesh was born after the flood around the same time frame as Nimrod would be. However, there are many crazy tales about this character, making him more mythological than real. But many ancient characters are often portrayed like that, you know, because they continually spread through word of mouth and it gets exaggerated and more tales get put onto that. So, and before it's actually finally written down on an official record. So, this guy could be the Nimrod. We really don't know. It's kind of like a guess. I guess if God really wanted us to know, but he didn't give them the credit of giving him his name. Same as he didn't give Satan the credit of knowing what his real name was. However, an Egyptologist, Douglas Petrovich, he argues that Sargon the Great, who built the first cities of Sumer and Akkad, is the one that best fits the historical data. He supports this theory on the, you know, he supports the similarities between Sargon and Nimrod, in that both Nimrod and Sargon came from the same region. Nimrod's origin in Cush matches Sargon's origin in the Sumerian Kish. Similar in names. Both peoples and territories were named after Cush or Kish, Noah's grandson. Both Nimrod and Sargon made Akkad a prominent city. Both Nimrod and Sargon initiated buildings in Assyria. The Bible reveals Nimrod built the principal cities of Assyria in verses 11 and 12 of Genesis chapter 10. Archaeologists' discoveries in Nippur, an ancient city in Mesopotamia, credit the same feat to Sargon, and they both created a lasting influence on Assyria. The Bible indicates Nimrod's exploits indelibly impacted the Israelites, since the prophet Micah equated the land of Assyria with the land of Nimrod in Micah chapter 5 and verse 6. Also, looking at some of the biblical datings, and there's a couple different versions of it, I kind of like this one here, but it places the flood sometime around 2304 BC plus or minus 11 years. Okay, Sargon of Akkad, also known as Sargon the Great, also known as Sargon-Nisera and Saru-Khan, meaning true king or legitimate king, reigned in Mesopotamia from 2334 to 2279 BCE. The dating could be off a little bit, but pretty close. Who knows? Could be Gilgamesh, could be Sargon, could be somebody else, but they kind of fit the descriptions of this person that set up this kingdom of Babylon. Now, there is more that makes them look like it's, you know, the same person, but overall, archaeology, excavations in ancient Mesopotamia provide historical evidence for Nimrod's identity as Sargon, and once again confirming the Bible rests on a solid historical foundation. So some of this could be true. Now others like Sace and Pinches and some others identify Nimrod with Marduk. Marduk, the Babylonian god. Of course, Gilgamesh and Sargon the Great were equated to that of a god as well in ancient Babylonian mythology and religion. And this is the key to this mystery, though. Regardless of who this Nimrod was, he opposed God. And he set out to rule the populace. After he established his empire, he formed a state religion, creating his own system of gods. He set it up that he would be worshipped as a deity. And of course, the worship of Satan as a sun god. Satan knows the plan of God. And he most likely influenced Nimrod to start this false religious system. In fact, he, or Satan, is the center of it. Not God. As this religion darkly mirrors God's true way. But it is distorted with lies. And we know who the father of lies is. Satan set up a counterfeit religious system which honors and worships him. Now through hundreds of corrupt religions, Satan has over the ages convinced billions of people to worship the sun, moon, the stars, animals, nature, deceased ancestors, imaginary gods and goddesses, and a bewildering variety of other things, or nothing at all. Even among the varieties of traditional Christianity, we find people divided and bickering over who and what God is, over his purpose for us, and over how he wants us to worship him and how we are supposed to live. The devil has done an effective job of confusing the people as to what the Bible really says. Again, I'm reading some more from this. Reading from this booklet, it says, Satan doesn't care which of these groups people fall into. Whether they believe in no God at all, accept or worship a false God, or are deceived into a false view of the true God and his plan for us. Satan still has them where he wants them. Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 18. Alienated from the life of God because of the arrogance or ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of their heart. Satan has effectively deceived the world throughout history by influencing human beings to cut themselves off from God's guidance. He has led us into wanting to do things our own way, to rely on ourselves rather than to rely on God as the ultimate authority. And God is the ultimate authority. In ancient Babylon, a governmental religious system began and spread throughout the whole world. All of the world's religions began at the Tower of Babel. When God divided them through language, they took the knowledge of these false gods that they were taught by Nimrod, by Gilgamesh, by Sargon, by Marduk, whoever it was, and they went into other lands prophesying the same gods, but now with different names according to their new language. Next Sabbath, we're going to explore how this mystery Babylon spread throughout the world's religions, including Christianity. We're going to see how this god Marduk is identified with every single other god that's out there. It's going to be pretty extensive. I'm going to have a nice handout that's going to show you how all the different names. See, Marduk actually had a trinity in Babylon. The very first trinity in Babylon with him, his wife, and his son. They are mentioned in the Bible. We're going to go through that. I'm going to show you how that is spread to all the different religions. But the worst part of it is I'm going to show you how it infected Christianity. And it's an interesting tale.